Jones, he married Mabel, a wise old owl was he. He told his wife he never drank a stronger thing than tea. But after honeymooning, at night he stayed away. And for a week he never got home till the break of day. At last poor Mabel asked the reason why. Said Jones, I'm going to tell the truth or die.
Hello and welcome back to our podcast, my fanfic or fanfic itself is a popular game of a post-apocalyptic wasteland and Marvel Pony, a popular show about pastel horses. Hi, I'm Fi, I'm joined once again with my co-host Weird. Say hello, Weird.
Once again, for the last time, fillies and ponies, this is your DJ Weirdington Esquire, doing a Wolfman Jack impersonation. I'm a sick puppy, sick as a dog, because we're about to journey into hell, the hell that is Thunderhead 2020.
Thunderhead.
Last time on Thunderhead 2020, we got a bunch of fucking backfill, explaining,
You right there?
Blackjack noticed that somebody left the mustard out for Sniff Sniff 3 days. From this, we can conclude that they're building a assassination squad on the moon to kill the queen.
Yeah, we got a bunch of weird backfill where characters just sort of intuited like stuff that had been happening on screen.
Yeah, they all just stood around going, of course, he has to have been doing this. It's the only way.
And so, yeah, Lifehugs has an army of cyborgs that are like, so much better than any cyborgs that, like, the Wasteland ponies can make, because the Enclave is just so cool.
Yes. The great and glorious Republic of the Enclave is its fabrication machines are so much more significant than the dirt grounders that they were able to fabricate even more superior cybernetics. The superior Pegasian cybernetics. God.
Anyway. That's about it. Like, a lot of fighting. We glorify a one of the good ones. Neo-Confederate Nazi. Hooftwaffen. And we end with at some point Rampage's character was assassinated by being petulant. Again, some more. There was something that, I forgot to do my notes because I've been too busy with clean living recently. I've been a little insight into my own life. I'm trying to like get fit and stuff. But I forgot to re-listen to last week's pod. There was something that seemed really obvious last week that caught up with me on a follow-up listen, and now it's completely left in my mind, so I guess it couldn't have been that significant after all. Oh, wait, there it is. I just found it in my brain. In my brain meat. In my brain space. Back in the in the deep processor, because for the purposes of the KFAB, I am a talking jukebox. Keep forgetting about that. So Thunderhead has been on top of, like, the final dungeon this entire time.
Yep.
And I kept missing that, and it came up last week, and I think that kind of bears mentioning. It bears mentioning on a lot of levels, primarily in the text. It should probably bear mentioning. It should probably be relevant. Oh, wait a minute. The source of all of our problems is directly under the other source of all of our problems.
Yeah.
like, shouldn't they be, like, I mean, they're doing something about it now, but only because, like, their hand has been sort of directly forced. Like so many big epic set pieces, like, it's not clear why they're here or what they want. Like, events in the plot aren't moved by anybody's desires.
Yeah. Certainly the protagonists have no impact on the story actually moving forwards, for sure.
Things just sort of happen.
Yeah, things
and
just
it
sort
happens
of
to them.
Yeah, I was going to say, things just sort of happen to them. And we as the audience have to try and, like, kind of just deal with that fact. But yeah, they've been underneath they've been on top of the core this entire time. Which, I mean, like, it makes sense from a, like, sort of from the story's perspective of the dumb quest. You remember the quest that they're on? Remember the quest that hasn't been talked about in, oh, a book, almost, at this point?
Determine what the Maltese.exe does exactly.
Yeah,
and why, like, everyone wants it, even though nobody wants it. And nobody could or should want it, because a desperately small number of people could actually access it in the first place.
Yeah, but they from a at least a narrative, not convenience, but like a narrative conservation standpoint, it makes sense to put your final couple of locations right next to each other, because that way you can have a quest get closer and closer to wherever they're going as you go along. So I can kind of understand that, at least from a conservation standpoint, but it is very funny of this, like, paradise built on top of hell.
I think I kind of imagine there might be some part of Sombra's mind that thinks that's clever. I'll give him a little bit of credit, and that might be intentional. His conception of the ideal world in the clouds, directly above a underground nightmare. I'm sure he, like, thinks he's very cute with that.
Yes.
But, like, it's weird, because, like, in the hands of a good writer, this would be, like, sound narrative conservation, and it would be evidenced by the fact that, like, all bad things flow from this one point, and
all wickedness stems from the core, that sort of thing.
That you would have Silver Wing or whatever his ass main bad guy from Inglourious Basterds with wings be in the same way as Dawn, like, tempted and maddened by the influence of the core, instead of, like, just incidentally doing his own thing. It reads as lazy rather than, like, efficient. Like, it's lazy in that it was just sort of farted together.
Yeah,
as opposed to a considerate, homogenized, holistic world.
What's the term? Utilitarian? It's perfunctory. It's, like, barely, like, it's just enough for everything to be knit together. And no other, like, there's no other depth considered than what needs to be done right away. But I think that's a great time to bring us into part two of Between the Wolf and the Lion, our season finale of book four. After this,
we what a fucking book, astonishingly pretentious name,
Between the Wolf and the Lion. Yes.
Yeah. All right. So, we last left the party, putt-putting, like, with Blackjack going,
yeah, just dragging it.
Telekinetically nudging a cloud, down into the body of the spire.
Mm-hmm.
To do what exactly? Did they even say, like, what they think they're going to accomplish in there?
Yeah, well, they need to stop. Gonna,
like,
yes, they did. Instead of just speculating, they explicitly said they need to cut the power to the missiles, which isn't how missiles work, as somebody pointed out. But, like, whatever, it's a narrative conceit. They need to stop the bad guy, and the way that they do that is they need to turn off the bad guy generator. But yeah, they need to cut the power that the Shadow Bolt Tower, because last week, they tricked Cognitum into helping them shut down the connection Shadowbolt Tower has to the core, so they can't draw power from that, so they can't turn the entire tower into a giant innovation beam and kill everybody that way by accident. But even still, the tower itself has enough auxiliary generators and power that Lighthooves... gonna activate those.
That slid right past me. that yeah. like I didn't even notice that they like the divine enemy, like the Satan herself, was tricked into just not doing their master plan. Hey, you know, you had a master plan that would like do everything you could possibly want. Just not do that.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing was basically like, you're like, I'm in the firing line, and that'll kill the EC-1101. So you like, you have an option. You have a choice here. Either you lose the golden ticket or you stop this. But yeah, so also an important detail that I forgot to bring up last week, because it's critically important. So you remember that feral child that has been accompanying them through the entire story?
Yeah, vaguely. Like you did remind us a few chapters ago when she was chewing on a steering wheel.
Yes. She's also going with Blackjack on this excursion to Shadowbolt Tower.
Let's bring the invalid into a new microwave hallway. That's
yeah. Yeah, she is it, on the excuse that, like, I don't know, she's really lucky, so maybe she'll help me out, I guess. And also she doesn't want to leave, I guess. So our party now consists of Blackjack the Wunderkind and a dog, basically. Like, it's Boo's characterization is really bizarre because she's basically a dog or like a feral child that can't talk. So like she doesn't contribute anything to the story besides being a cute mascot. And I personally hate that kind of character that has like basically nothing to contribute to but to roll around and be adorable. Yeah. They boot scoot their little cloud into the tower. We get a lot of descriptions of the tower's interior being like mostly untouched and covered in cobwebs and having that sort of like dry staleness of a room that hasn't been accessed for, you know, decades, let alone centuries. They fight a bunch of turrets because of course they do, because robots have always been exciting to fight in this story, and definitely not a waste of our time. But the only real important part of this particular scene is the fact that Blackjack finds a bunch of notes and documents that, like, I guess were Lighthooves, like, were in Lighthooves' possession, because, like, she also finds, like, a fort, basically, that belonged to Lighthooves, like when he was a kid, because we learned in the previous chapter that, like, Lighthooves and his brother, Chicanery, like, used the Shadowbolt Tower kind of as, like, a base that they kind of, like, hung out in when they were little kids. But we find it a thing that, like, a thing that that's going to come up a couple of times in the story in this chapter. So I should probably try to explain it now as best as I understand. So Sombra has a huge problem with the concepts of setup and payoff. And the specific context of what I'm going to be talking about, setup and payoff kind of has like three or four steps, but you can kind of just boil down to three steps for the purpose of what I'm talking about. There's your setup state, your setup part, your reminder part, and then your payoff. So generally when you tell a story about, and you have an interesting quirk you want to have about a character or some plot detail you want to come back up again, you initially set up that it's present, you remind the audience at some point about it, and then you pay it off by having it matter in the story. You know, you introduce the gun in chapter one, you remind people of the gun's presence in chapter three during a tense moment, and then chapter five, you fire the gun, right? That's the sort of like core Chekhov's gun concept, right?
Yeah, introduce the gun, remind us of the gun, fire the gun.
Pour it out for a gun. And that's like the basic, that is a very, very basic sort of storytelling device. So we're going to get into why you need the reminder step. Especially in a very long form, very verbose story like this, especially with months and months of delays between individual chapters. BJ finds a bunch of like newspaper clippings and references to one of Thunderhead's like first. Like founding members, which is a person named Dr. Mephitus or something like that. It doesn't matter. it's not important for this conversation. To establish some of the problems with this already, like this talking about setup and payoff, right? During the Yellow River Massacre, which was, what, like a book and a half ago at this point? Wait, when did the Yellow River Massacre? It happened chapters and chapters ago at the very least. I think it happened before Hightower, so that would have been last book. This is the only other time this character has ever been referenced. And we are expected to remember his plot and place in the story. And this is where the reminder step is really important. Because we're missing a step of reminder, and it's also important to remember that a reminder step doesn't need to be a simple, codified, single reminder. You could theoretically remind multiple times about a plot detail. It's important, though, when you have literally years go by at World of Your Story, that when you bring up a plot detail that is only referenced once, that you need to remind the audience of its presence, or otherwise it's very easy to forget who a character is. And that was certainly the case with this, with Dr. Mephidus. This is a very important plot point that is required to understanding the psychology of the current antagonist, and also the reason why this plot is happening currently. And the plot detail is nestled in a single reference dozens of chapters ago. This is extremely bad writing.
Yeah, I would say so. I would say so, yes.
This is a very easy way to lose your audience. There will be a similar situation coming up where a character is given a name once and we're expected to remember who that is when they finally throw their mask off later on in the story. They go, "It's me!"
And then no one knows who. From accounting, you met me in chapter one.
Yeah. It's Johnson Smith. No, Smith Corporation. Yeah. Everything's a prosody bit. But in this important context, Dr. Mephidus ran the Yellow River internment camp / concentration camp during the Zebra stuff in the past war. He grossly violated his position. He got a lot of people killed by locking them in the prison and then running off with all the money. It's revealed in this chapter that what happened to him is he escaped to the Enclave, where he then became a person in a position of power because of all the money he had, stealing it from the prison. That is a critical plot point of importance, but the point I'm trying to definitely emphasize is that when writing, you need to establish who characters are and remind the audience, because otherwise it is very easy to forget core names and details. But anyways, after this important detail has been dropped on us, Chicanery shows back up in the story because of course he does.
You know, honestly, as frustrating as the like lamp shading, like I can be a shitty writer as long as I like point to it and say it wasn't that bad. Wasn't that a bad thing I did? Isn't it annoying that I did that to you as a reader? I actually would kind of respect if, like, Blackjack, like, read this and went, "Who?" and only fucking the Fallen or somebody who would reasonably have, like, an eidetic memory or something be able to, like, remind her.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
even better if only one character in the current party selection had any idea.
Yeah, the only person who's been paying attention to all, like, the person who's been reading the script the whole time. but yeah, we get elaborated on Chicanery and his dumb backstory with Lighthooves. So it's revealed that when they were little kids, Lighthooves was obsessed with the concept of his cutie mark and obsessed with the concept of legacy and what we leave behind and the idea of history and ancestry, because admittedly, this kind of does work in the story's favor, that the main villain of this is someone who bought so hard into the Enclave that it fucked him up, because he so believed in its tenets of tradition and history and legacy and bloodlines that it fucked him up super bad to find out that his ancestor was this doctor, because the the Enclave peddle such a strong sense of bloodline determinism, the idea that, like, this, like, monstrous, barbaric traitor to his own people is in his blood shook him super bad. And that's what kind of led him on this, like, terminal course. Which, like it's an idea. I think I like it. I think that it would be better served in a story that was completely focused on this Enclave stuff, and this isn't just an afterthought in a much bigger plotline that has nothing to do with this. But the idea of a villain who is more or less just a logical conclusion of the kind of rhetoric that that leads to his kind of indoctrination is interesting. Like, the idea of a character who's just red-pilled super hard. Like, he bought all of it, like, just, and is now just a fucking, a sociopathic, dangerous time bomb because of it, is an interesting sort of position to put a villain in. Cool, we get more discussions about cybernetics because, of course, like, they're BJ and, Chicanery are talking about, like, the sort of position, like, the whole cybernetics thing that has been introduced in the story as of last chapter, with all these cybernetic pigacy. And there's this more of this fucking thing that I really, which I was, like, a lot before about how, the story does that bullshit thing that, like, Shadowrun does and Cyberpunk does, where cybernetics makes you less human.
Yeah, we've talked about that a little bit in the past. Yeah, it's just, but now we're finally getting to it. Where
it really rears its ugly head in this chapter again. Like, BJ is adamant that you lose part of yourself when you become cybernetic, and that's why you shouldn't do it.
I don't know, BJ. Maybe that has something to do with, like, you being also a ghoul, also a zombie, a reanimated corpse that also has robot pieces plugged into it.
Yeah. No, that has nothing to do with it.
Real quick, while I have the floor. You know what? Actually, no. This is more of a topic to. I changed my mind again. So the light hooves thing, kind of is almost interesting, almost a good idea, except that there's a couple problems. One, he's like all of Sombra's villains, framed as being fundamentally correct. Whenever he's, like, talking to anybody, he always, destroys the heroes with facts and logic. The other is that, like, his response is the fact that he's the villain, like, after, like, discovering, like, his tainted heritage sort of proves the Enclave's ideology right. You'd expect this sort of, like, that sort of reveal to, like, happen to a character who is the villain because they embody everything about the Enclave, and they think their lineage is pure, and then they, like, have the rug pulled out from under them. Or you could use it as a way of, like, displaying a character's hypocrisy that they know about and have been hiding. That their own connection to this ideal lineage is flawed, but to, like, find out that they're like have this person who is perfectly dedicated to the ideals of tradition and the purity of lineage, find out that their lineage is impure and then become bad and do bad things as a result.
Well, again, I kind of like this, but I think that we need to get a little bit farther into it. There's a little bit more to it, but we got to get into it. And there's a lot more chapter to handle. But yeah, we've got more of this prosthetics makes you evil shit, which, I mean, like, again, just, like, fuck off. Like, any writer that does this is a fucking hack. Like, because it's like, hey, does a person with a robotic arm become a less human because of their robotic arm? Then what is to say about a person who chooses to not have cybernetics installed and just has, like, a missing limb? Like, are they more a person?
It's extremely Victorian. It's extremely holistic full body phrenology. Ours, it's I think it this sort of psychology, this sort of, like, thinking relates to A lot of conservative hysteria over tattoos.
The body's a temple that's been given to you by God. That kind of shit. But yeah, then Chicanery decides to drop a bomb on them because they're like, okay, we need to get to the generators. And it's like, oh yeah, I know where they are. They're in the stable. So we get a bomb dropped on us that Shadowbolt has a full working stable in it. Bum, bum, bum. This scene is dumb for a myriad of reasons. Because this scene tries to decry the existence of what's happening to these people while simultaneously masturbating to how cool it is. Chicanery leads BJ to... oh, fuck, I just realized how hacky this is. Sorry, it didn't occur to me until this very second. So we learn in this instance that Chicanery and Light Hooves were both stable kids. Well, because that way Light Hooves is just... you know, a literal parallel. He's another stable dweller who came up and tried to change the world himself. But he went bad, unlike Blackjack.
Okay.
I don't want to talk about this too much, but seriously, anyone who listens to me that has any interest in writing fanfiction in this setting, don't do this. This is one of the most cliched things you can do is have like make your characters all stable dwellers. Just don't. Just make them anything else, please. I beg of you.
In an inexplicable sky stable, like that. Like yes. I don't.
Oh, those exist. Okay, those are established in the original story. Like this isn't.
Okay, I don't know how to grok a sky bunker.
Most of them were built in the tops of mountains. Most of them are gone because. Because the Enclave needs metal, so they, like, decades ago, they just raided them all. It's a whole thing we can get into at some point later, I guess. But the important part with this is it goes to great length to establish how diverse this stable is in comparison to all the other ones, which, so it has, like, you know, unicorns and earth ponies and Pegasi. It's got the whole shebang. It's got a weird thing going on with it where it has like there's a lot of like posters about like, you know, we all have to do this together, we have to all have to come together to make this work. And there's a weird there's this weird thing where there's all the writing, like all the prose talks about how this thing is basically this thing is basically paradise, but we're gonna get into how that's fucking stupid in a second. You know, everyone's just happy-go-lucky, you know, everyone's hunky-dory. And get into one of my more aggravating details about this, but one of the things is BJ's like, I don't understand how you guys are so close to the core and haven't been hit by enervation. How any of you haven't turned into liquid? And they're basically like, gosh golly shucks, we don't know nothing about any that enervation. Because of course, enervation is stemmed by like, friendship, basically, like literally the magic of friendship. It's reduced by like communities being good, but because again, as often, Sombra is an absolute goddamn chud. Bastions of civilization that are protected from the innovation are incredibly suspect. Considering Megamart is one of these places, the Reaper's Arena is one of these places, and apparently Sky Prison is also one of these places.
Yeah, this is really, man, this is really kind of sending me. This is kind of like I was up until exactly this point, you'd think in the hands of like any other writer, like this would be the 1920s movie Metropolis that like, oh, look at this sort of pristine paradise we have, like this hyper idealized society, this homogenous, perfect gilded city. But just underneath are the people reduced to cogs in the machinery that maintains it all, a prison society. Dwelling just underground, indistinguishable from the machines they maintain. But no, they're not slaves. They're serfs. they are very technically not enslaved, and they're extremely happy about it.
Yes, Yeah, it's a dumb Gilded Cage show. So, like, so they have to go meet the Overmare, but, like, Supper really has, like is really, really pissy about every goddamn thing. So, in the original story, they're just called Overmares because it's just, like, whatever. It's just because the nomenclature of MLP dictates that any opportunity to replace something with a horse pun must be replaced with a horse pun. So instead of Overseer, it's Overmare. But Somber in his infinite pissiness is like, no, it should be called an Overpony because that way it's gender neutral. And it's like the pissiest thing. Like, just because this is Stable 99 again. Like, Stable 99 was an evil matriarchy. So, like, which in itself is a snipe at the original story as well, because there's a patriarchy stable. And I guess Somber just never let go of that axe. But yeah, anyways, we meet the Overpone. Her name is Farsight. She's blind. You get it? She,
Yeah.
But she, oh man, I hate this so much. So, like, it's important to remember that, like I said, the prose implies how diverse and cool this stable is. And then they immediately talk to Farsight, and she's like, oh yeah, we live in a gilded cage, and we can't leave here, and we also can't make weapons or anything like that, because this stable is like a weird fabricating stable. And it's one of those things where it's like, I don't understand, like, these things are such at odds with each other that, like, it's a perfect example of, like, tell instead of showing, where it's like, we're shown this gilded cage, but the problem is that, like, everyone's happy in the gilded cage. Everyone is happy and cared for, and there's a huge emphasis on diversity. And then we're told by Farsight that, oh no, this is actually a prison, and we're discouraged from rearing anybody besides unicorns because it's what's useful to the Enclave. But we're not shown that. we're shown a racial parity within this stable, and then told the exact opposite. Like, that's definitionally bad writing. That is. Absolutely contradictory.
I mean, the contradiction is so heavy that, like, normally you would think that this is, like, an indication that the person is lying to
our protagonist.
Yeah, and also, like, within the metaphysics of the setting, within the physics of the setting, this has to be a lie, because, like, they're manifestly producing happiness energy.
They are producing friendship.
We're actually bottling it. The contentment meters are through the roof. Just look at the porter quota. Like, it's.
But yeah, and then we get an insufferable lampshade hang, like, where characters just describe the plot to you, which is insufferable. Where, like, Farsight's, well, what are you going to do now that you know that there's a stable down here? Because you're just coming here to blow up the place. And she's like, I don't know. I don't really have a plan now. And then Farsight's like, oh, you now have a difficult choice between these stable dwellers and saving Thunderhead. Truly, I do not envy your position. It's like, you can't just have
to the cable. Like, I don't understand why you'd have to destroy the entire thing just to, like, flip the breaker off. I don't. What the fuck?
Because I guess they could turn it back on, and they don't want that. Well, the setting is so fast and loose with, like, what technology could do that, like, you could physically just hit a breaker box and pull out the fuses, but then, like, a person could hack it back on in this story, because that shit happens basically all the time. There's very little account for the difference between, like, physical technology.
Manual versus remote access.
But that's super cool. BJ just has the plan of, like, oh yeah, right.
So this time the head of the dead babies is the one to preemptively guilt Blackjack over time to kill some babies again. Time to God has decreed that I must once more kill some babies.
Lord forgive me for what I must do. And she's loading a gun. but for once, the story actually has a plan C option. She's like, oh, the surface is full of people that could help you. I have a whole stable that I gas that you can go live in. They're going to shack up in Stable 99 with the Steel Rangers. There is a baffling line that a friend pointed out where Farsight point blanks, like, will we be slaves on the surface too? And instead of saying no, like a real sensible hero would go, she goes, you'll have to take that up with the Steel Rangers. It's just like, come on. How are you the worst? How are you the worst that's ever been? But yeah, cool. Now the plan is they're just going to take spark batteries and just throw them at cyborgs for a while, because that way they can get to the other, because they need to shut down the assembly line that's making the cyborgs as well, obviously, because now it's a new threat. So they overhear a couple of cyborgs arguing about the whole, like, their state of their existence, talking about how awful it is, because, you know, like, we really need to enforce how, like, disgusting and degenerate people with prosthesis are, but they can't feel anything anymore, and they're terrified of their inability to feel pain, and, like, they're just freaking out really bad. One of them is, like, yelling about it, is his dick still there, which, is, admittedly, out of context, is pretty high comedy. It's just... Everyone's like, oh, do I even have a soul? Other man, where's my dick?
What did they do with my penis? Fool. You have ascended. You have become a I was gonna say transhuman, but you have ascended above. You are in the next evolution in pony kinds. You have a range of penis options available to you now. Vibrating, ridged,
spins,
pneumatic.
prehensile. But yeah, they spark battery a bunch of cyborgs and they fall over. There's a weird thing that this chapter is really establishing where, like, there's a lot of, like, BJ and chicanery kind of flirting, which is sort of, like, again, one of those things where, outside of the context of the story, is kind of cute, given that, like, everything about Blackjack and all of her relationships up to this point, like, it's just kind of like, what are you doing? Like, why is literally every male that ever Blackjack ever runs to falling over her? Like, she's mostly a tin can at this point. There's more push on the whole, like, cybernetics thing, because Chicanery finds the assembly line, and he talks about the concept of how rad it is that, like, cyborgs are seemingly better in every way, and BJ's like, no, they're not, they're terrible, and this is why, and then provides a bulleted list of all the reasons why cyborgs suck. And further reiterating the whole, like, the only reason why I survived is because I had my friends.
Friends is a strong word.
It is.
People use around here, so with Blackjack.
I use the term well-wisher in the way that I don't wish you any particular harm. Because this whole thing is really, really hinging on the idea that Blackjack, who is made of tin cans and scrap and junk metal, needs, like, an upgrade to be able to handle the new line of cyborgs, which is just, like, sure. The last one didn't do anything. So, like, the plan is, like, because they also have, like, another person with them named Twister that they found.
It's like Krillin getting his full potential unlocked.
Here's the peak. It's all downhill from here. But yeah, they plug her into a cybernetic-o-matic, I guess. And, like, joking aside, the scene is actually pretty rad. Because, like, she's locked into it, and, like, they basically turned her pain off. Like, she can't feel the machinery going into her, but she can see it. And so, like, there's this really, like, kind of crazy tense scene where, like, she's talking to Chicanery, and she's trying to get Chicanery to, like, just tell her anything, like, just tell her stories, just make up bullshit, whatever, to try and, like, get her to go through this. Why she's not sedated doesn't make any sense, but I guess, like, I guess they just didn't want to hit her with a memory orb for once. they didn't have a new memory orb to hit her with, so she's just like, nah, I can take it. But it, admittedly, jokes aside, this scene is relatively cool of, like, seeing parts get, like, pulled out of her and all this, like, machinery goring into her while she's, like, trying to stay calm is really cool. There's a particular scene that always really stuck with me of, like, them, like, pulling all of the, like meat parts off of her face entirely. It's, like, to reveal the kind of, like, terrifying Terminator, like, endoskeleton inside of her is really cool. That has always stuck with me. Like, that's something that just has stuck with me since, like, I read it the first time.
When was this published compared to the recent RoboCop reboot?
I have no idea, but this is
might be an interesting thing to do to check the timeline on that, because this is a thing
that RoboCop did. But regardless of what it's referencing, it's still
Samson's did it. RoboCop did it.
Yeah, it's still like I'm trying to like find the thing I liked about this chapter. It's
and good for you. That's a positive, positive way of looking. Thing to do with your time. Just grab hold of that silver lining.
Yep, that's what I'm gonna do. Cause get ready for this. As they're operating on her, they're like, "Oh, we've detected foreign material in her." What? Oh, she's pregnant. apparently, that time that she drunkenly date raped 21 was enough for her to conceive a child. So now she's pregnant, and she's planning on keeping it, because there is like a kind of there's an up in the air moment where they're like, "Well, we can just abort it if you want," and she's like, "Nah, whatever. If the child dies in me, the child dies in me." And there's also a thing where. They need, like, she'll have to, like, surrogacy spell teleport the baby into somebody else's uterus eventually because it won't be able to live in her cybernetic body. But yeah.
So.
She's
a corpse that before dying was 90% cancer. What? Yeah. What?
Apparently, that's still enough to conceive a baby.
Is it a damn pure, at least? Is it like
God,
like what sort of holy, unholy, like sort of so, spawn could result from?
So you say damn pure, and like the worst part about this could have also have been Stygius's kid, and that would have been rad, to be entirely honest.
Yes.
You're
not wrong.
Then you would have gotten your damn pure baby. But, like, the explanation is insane, too, because, like, oh, I have an implant. There's no way I could have gotten pregnant. And the line verbatim is, "Your body must have detected it as a foreign substance and then digested it using your digestion spells, like it would have done anything else." So her...
What? What?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So she was able to be pregnant for months now at this point.
I mean, that's better than what I was like. I had a deep terror that you were going to say that, like, it was magic. That he was going to do the Republican senator thing of, like, legitimate rape. Like they're going to say that, well, your body wanted a baby. And so, like...
So it's having that baby, goddammit.
Half zombie baby. It's gonna be very fine, I'm sure. Gonna burst out of the surrogate mother like a xenomorph.
Can only hope. Fully clad in cybernetics. She comes out of the booth looking absolutely fucking ridiculous. So she has wings now because she's a full-on cyborg alicorn. She looks suspiciously similar to Raiden from Metal Gear Rising. She is like head to toe clad in metal. One of my favorite details about her because of the way this is, she doesn't have eyes anymore. She just has like a solid visor that has like a Cylon eye in it.
Word for Gigan.
Like
I can't think of any other, like, Mr. LaForge. I don't know.
Yeah, she just has, bored. Like, she has an eye laser eye. Boy, howdy, do I want to redesign this so bad, because all the concept art...
Zaku? She has, like, a Zaku?
Yeah, she's got a Zaku eye.
All right.
I want to redesign this so bad, because fuck, is this design terrible. Because it's all, like, she's like, it's all black metal and red, and has giant cybernetic wings, and, like, that could be cool, but, like, the interpretation is way too literal for a lot of people, so it just looks ridiculous, and everyone always goes, like, matte black and hard reds for everything, so there's no contrast anymore. But there's a weird detail about it where her, like, her top half of her head is cut off, is now been, like, replaced with, like, the visor part. But, like, something I was thinking about the shower today is the fact that, like, her bottom half, like, her jaw is metallic, like, it's all metal. So there's no reason to have the bottom half, because it's not meat. It's just, so she has, like, endoskeleton meat facsimile, but only on the bottom half of her head, and the top half is all metal, which is just, like, weird. Like, it's just weird. Like, clearly Sombra was...
Oh, wait, now it's also more Robert Kopp than ever.
Yes.
With, I guess, a Zaku eye floating around in there?
Yeah, it looks a lot like the reboot, like the black and red RoboCop that they went with for the reboot.
Uh-huh. More speculative evidence of the Robert Kopp hypothesis.
Yes.
God, this sucks.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. She goes nuts because she's like, I'm a monster, because she can't handle being this cybernetic, I guess. But she needs the edge.
Okay.
Well, it's also because, you know, cybernetics eat your soul. She has really low essence now, so she now has cyberpsychosis, I guess.
I don't know. All I can think about now is hoping Sombra's going to prove us wrong about the whole, like, he cannot, will not allow her to beat a man, because, like, well, he's an innovator and always willing to buck convention, but, like, the standard story logic would be that, like, she gets to confront Whitey Hooves again and trounce him to demonstrate how much more powerful this form is. But
yes, she
remains to be seen.
Yeah,
so anyway, how do they stop her from going berserk and killing them all? Because
Boo calms her down by finally being able to talk. She can say her first words, which is "Blackjack," in the cutesiest way possible, and that calms her down. I really don't like Boo at all. I don't like mascot characters very much in the first place, because they contribute very little, and I hate this community's weird love of this character, because she adds nothing to the story and is really annoying. But here we are. She talks like a little baby child and says "Blackjack," because she's adorable.
I can't give, like, unfortunately, like, I am contractually obligated to not be able to give this shit, because that's this is actually it's a decent premise, like a from the mouth of babes, like, you're still you and you are still valid, like, whatever your weird, like it from, because the setup seems to read, at least to me, like Blackjack's cyborg prejudice, like the it's Blackjack's problem.
She's so racist against cyborgs. That was
her internalized bigotry against prosthetics.
I suppose, but I feel like
and from the mouth of babes, like, being able to, like, step forward and identify her true essence in spite of, like, her menacing appearance.
But, like, could you imagine
a pretty
how
good
much...
sort of?
But could you imagine how much better this scene could have possibly been if, like, all of her friends came together to calm her down? Like, actually had them matter as emotional support?
Yeah, that would be... Yeah, that would be better if, like, a person, like, was able to, like, do that. But it's like, not unheard of. Like, it's sound enough as a premise.
Yeah, I suppose I'm just very hard on it, because I really don't like Boo at all.
Yeah.
So it doesn't.
It's a valid feeling. I can't.
now we have this stupid scene. So there's like a whole thing where they're like in a, they're in a, they get into like a firefight with cyborgs in a like stairwell, and BJ tries to use her wings for the first time, which is so comical and stupid. It really undercuts the whole like coolness of
ascendance
getting...
of her like rad new.
Yeah, because she just like flies like a turkey basically, and then just like lands like an idiot, and then like everyone laughs at her. And it's just like, why? I don't understand why you did this. Like, it's not funny. It just really undercuts how, like, you get this, you know, main character, you know, finally is getting serious, and she's made this, like, this extra sacrifice to, like, cybernetic her body even more, even though she hates it. And she's become, like, an implement of death, the thing she despises the most. And then she's just, like, dum-ba-dum, flying around like an idiot. Like the vulture from Looney Tunes, basically. And it's just like, why put this in the scene? It really undercuts how anything that could have been possibly salvaged from this.
Yeah, well, Sombra's bad.
Yep, Sombra's bad.
What happens next?
So they beat up a bunch of cyborgs. They find out that at some point Rampage has stolen a raptor by beating up one of its captains that has now commandeered it. So she now has a pirate. Like, she's like, I'm going to be a sky pirate now. And I'm all for it. Like, finally Rampage feels like she's in her element.
That feels like the Rampage we know.
We know and love. Because they're like, they're going to get all the stable, like, onto the raptor, and they're going to evacuate it. And, like, you know, I do appreciate that Raptor, like, Rampage's first scene of seeing her as a siren is like, oh, you look even cooler now. Because Rampage's taste is terrible. And there's admittedly a like pretty funny Punch and Judy bit where, like, she has the captain basically, like, tied up by a rope and is, like, beating him severely. And he keeps, like, begging Rampage, like, sorry, not Rampage, BJ, to, like, let him go and, like, offering him, all, like, he'll offer her anything. And it's like, I don't trust him. He sold out every member of his crew and they still beat on him. But there is this establishing this thing that you have to bear with it because it's actually pretty badass. But there's a weird thing where BJ's like, because BJ knows that Lighthouse can like spy on her at any time. So she like has a plan that she doesn't show to the audience. And she's like, okay. But she shows like a piece of paper to Rampage. And she's like, this is my plan. This is my trump card. And Rampage is like, oh, that's pretty crazy. But we don't get to see it, which I think is actually a really interesting narrative setup. It's a good, like we were talking about setups and payoff before. I think this is a really good setup, having this established thing that, like, I cannot tell you what it is, but assured everyone's reacting to it as if it's the craziest thing that BJ's ever done, and that is a tall order. But BJ is really saying a lot of final goodbyes to her crew at this point, and there's a lot of plans of, like, what they're planning to actually do now, because they're like, okay, we just need to get Thunderhead to the ground. There is a comical statistic given. So, like, apparently at some point, like, so, like, we said before that the population of Thunderhead is 50,000. Apparently it's somewhere between 60,000 and 70,000. There is no way the surface, specifically the Hoof, could accommodate 70,000 people suddenly showing up. Most of the factions, like, the Reapers was considered significant because they had 100 people.
But again, like, my impression was that they were exclusive because they had 100 people. That only the 100 strongest in all the waste can
step
to this rodeo.
But my point is that even 100 badasses is like nothing. Like, it's just it's a matter of scale. Like 50,000 is a lot of goddamn people. It just really like blows the scale of the story up.
I have no idea if that's true. Like, I know that, like, in KCAT's version, like, that would be an astonishing number, but I really don't have any concept of what Sombra thinks is the sense of scale is for the greater Hoofington metropolitan area.
Yeah. I would say, in my best guesstimation of the Hoof, has about 1,000 people. But just by, like, context clues and descriptions of things and the importance of the number of characters and stuff, I would say that, like, there's 1,000 to maybe 2,000 people in the Hoof in its entirety. That's every faction, every warm body, every sentient ghoul that would encapsulate about 1,000 people. So still a spit in the in a pond for the number of people that they're suddenly taking on as refugees. It's an astronomical number.
Well, there goes the neighborhood.
Yeah. I don't know where it is, but there's a scene where Rainbow Dash is like, because they need to evacuate the city. So Rainbow Dash's plan is, instead of evacuating the city, they're just gonna push Thunderhead. They're just gonna get the 70,000 Pegasi bodies and just push the city away from the tower. Which is a SpongeBob joke. We just pick up the city and push it somewhere else.
It's mighty dumb in the context of how serious Sombra's insisted this shit is supposed to be, but in a pony world, I don't know.
It's perfectly valid.
Seems sound to me for small magical horses, but small magical horses that rape and say the fuck.
But yeah, BJ gets into a sky fight that's incredibly stupid and terrible, and further showcases how lame this upgrade really is. Because all the new cybernetics are way more taxing on our systems, including the wings, which are giant power eaters. So she just, fights for, maybe 10 minutes poorly, and then just falls out of the sky like a stone.
Amazing. Amazing. Don't worry, guys. During my time away, I learned the Kaioken. I soiled my pants, guys.
I fell over. Oh, you can have no one help me.
I don't. This is a satiric masterwork. This is a Kaufman-esque prank, isn't it? This can't be real.
Yeah, I've just been playing a trick on you for the last hour. No, this is real. This is all in the test.
No, I mean that Somber is can't be this stupid. He's playing at it, right? He's just fucking with us.
No, I guarantee that
the whole game.
I guarantee that the reason why this is being done is because people always complained that BJ was too overpowered. So this is reinforcing that, she has very defined weaknesses. It's totally balanced. And it's but it's also lame. It's not cool. She doesn't get to do anything interesting with it, though.
What the fuck? The new competitive meta. We're patching Blackjack. We're adding a new skin to Blackjack, but it comes with a set of debuffs.
It cripples all of her abilities. But yeah, she gets...
Hopefully, we're looking to maintain her tanky playstyle without...
sacrificing all of her kit. But yeah, I got lots more, by the way. This is nowhere near the end of the chapter.
All right.
RBD saves her out of the sky, which is cool. They have a little shindig to regroup and figure out what the hell's going on. BJ asks about Lighthooves' mission... or what happened to him. And yeah, RBD reiterates that Lighthooves went down to the surface and something fucked him up so bad that he has been on this suicidal mission the entire time afterwards, but tricked her into thinking that it was just to scare the Enclave into being better, when Lighthooves just wanted to burn the whole thing down, essentially, as it turns out. She also shows her the piece of paper, and even RBD is like, oh, you're fucking crazy. I don't want anything to do with this. The only thing that she hints at is that good luck targeting that thing anywhere. And so the plan is they're just going to steal one of the targeting spells, like one of the targeting talismans, off of the missiles, which the targeting talismans were established, like, oh gosh, hundreds of chapters now at this point, back when they first met up with Lighthooves and he was stealing these missiles. But yeah, and then, you know, just to actually, you know, progress the main plot, BJ, like, hits a thing on her pit bug that's like, oh, you're in the right location, so we're going to calculate the route to the next location. And of course, the next location is Ron Bronco headquarters, which is in the center of the core. They have to go to the core for the next one, however they're going to do that. But who cares? It's the main
story. It's really funny that the voice of God has to tell them that, like, okay, the next place that you're arbitrarily going to wander, because you have, like, no sense of self or desire or free will, is going to be the core, instead of, like, everything bad happening to our world and our home is in the core. We should probably go to the core.
Nah.
No, we have to wait for the MacGuffin to tell. The Oracle must speak.
Anyways,
fuck
they
you,
have
Somber. You fucking useless idiot.
Yeah, you just bad writer. Fuck. So we have to now contact BJ Linares to contact Glory to get a hold of her because they need to like touch base and figure out what the plan is to evacuate. But before that, so they ping pong and try to like find places where BJ is, and their first plan was like, okay, if we can't find Glory, we'll try and talk to Dr. Morningstar and figure out from there where Glory is. And you're gonna have to bear with me for this one, folks. You're gonna have to really come together on this one. But when they activate the controls screen panel sci-fi doodad, instead of Morningstar, they get like BJ describes her as like the most breathtakingly attractive woman they have ever seen in their entire life. Like they are cartoonishly pornographically attractive is the way it's described.
Okay.
And they're like, oh, we're looking for Dr. Morningstar. And they're like, oh, I'm Dr. Morningstar. And they're like, what? And it's like, oh yeah, I exposed myself to a bunch of killing joke and now I look like this. We will get this explanation for a few chapters, but it's too juicy, and I love this too much. This is the only thing I like about the story anymore now. Morningstar exposed themselves to Killing Joke just to see what had happened, seemingly on the hope that it would like do this to them, because they made an offhand joke before it that if only they were as attractive as they were smart. They're now cursed so that the smarter they are, the more ridiculously pornographically attractive they look. Which, audience, this was a worry given my artistic profession.
I'm staring into the sky. I don't looking for answers in the clouds, in the vast gray blanket above me, and yet none come, and yet no one came.
But I choose to interpret this as a unintentional bit of fuck you. I'm gonna be a lady if I like to, so I'm going to refer to Dr. Morningstar using female pronouns because they start doing so as well. And regardless of what Somber's intent this was, this is a fetish. Whoopsie doopsie.
Yes. Like, I'm just thinking about like stuff I've seen about trans eggs, as they're called, trans people who like cross-dress ironically a bunch, and like I just can't stop thinking about that when like what the fuck happened to you? Killing joke. I'm really messed up about this result. I'm really really upset that this happened. Oops. Oh no.
Oh no, now I'm a hot lady. How could this happen to me? But yeah. Oh Christ. Morningstar trans bimbo confirmed. Oh, this listeners, this damaged me as a person when I remembered this scene because of my artistic profession. So, which was
He's a
very
pornographer, you see.
yes.
He's a titty smith.
Yes.
So yeah, it's a deep cut. It's
It's a deep
very
cut.
specific.
I can't believe Somber made the vacation canon. It's so good. It's so good.
Still staring at the sky. Still
it's
waiting for answers from on high.
so good.
But there's only void above.
It's only void. But yeah, I just really everyone needs to know.
Okay.
But
And then what
anyways,
happens?
and then what happens? Hey, right, so completely unrelated to that, I contact Dawn, or not Donna, Glory and Sky
No
Striker.
foul.
Yes. They have a moment where they're like, "Oh, BJ, you turned yourself into even more of a Frankenstein. That's not good." But they yeah, the plans to evacuate and or move the entire Thunderhead away. They show the piece of paper to them. Everyone's all real nervous about it. Yeah, this is where the mechanic of this is when the line of 60 to 70,000 people really like happened again, and it really threw me off. Anyways, we're getting into the actual final scene, the final set piece of the chapter of book four, season finale. This scene is actually pretty kick-ass, despite all the shit that took us to get here. So BJ goes to the foundation block of the thing. There's this like crazy description of like missiles and like catwalks, like all in this big like open hexagonal building where all these cyborgs are working on stuff and just kind of lolling around waiting for something to happen. They're all kind of unsure what to actually do now that BJ has just walked right into their front door and up down the catwalk. And like BJ's like, "No, I just want to talk to your boss." And Light Hooves does like a villain proclamation over a loudspeaker, which is really funny because like BJ's like, "No, nah, I don't have time for you. Just come out and talk to me." But he this was a better setup, and this was like the main boss of a story of the entire story. This would be pretty cool that he's like ha sort of like haggard and sleepless and broken, and like textually this is supposed to be because like the cybernetics are kind of fucking with him now, but like it's better if it's more of a symbolic gesture of like the weight of all of his actions and terrible crimes are starting to physically manifest on him. So that's what I choose to believe.
Yes, valid. Correct.
He's basically unraveling in front of her and like doing the like maniacal like all of his composure is completely slipped at this point because BJ like just knows the story now that like you're not doing this because you're trying to save people. You're not doing this because you're trying to help people. You're doing this because you knew that you couldn't bring the information of Dr. Mephitus to the Enclave because they'd bury it, and everything he had known as it was a lie, and that damaged his sense of psyche and self so completely that his only reaction and solution was to tear the entire enclave down. Which, like, again, it's important to remember that outside of the bizarre rehabilitation that Somber has kept doing to this story, the enclave are Nazis. So the idea of a like Nazi coming to terms with the fact of like, "Oh no, we're the baddies," is a pretty strong kind of like arc to have. And it's still easy to see why he's the bad guy, though, in the sense that his solution to the Enclave isn't to just wipe out the Enclave. It's a total, utter, omnicidal destruction of the species, which, he's the bad guy, of course. Like, that makes more sense for him to be less reasonable, I guess. So I can totally buy this, I guess. A lot of Somber's framing of this is poor, obviously. But in this moment, the idea of like BJ actually fighting a bad guy who more or less believes in the same thing she does, but has just taken all the wrong lessons from it, is strong. It's reminiscent of Dawn. Like it really is, and it's a strong moment, especially when like Lighthooves is like, you know, you've joined Navarro. Like, what does that say about you? Like, or you know that you've joined the fascists. And BJ's like, you idiot, I'm not on anybody's side. There's more going on than this stupid little war between your two sides. Which I like. Like, I like that characterization. This is one of those rare moments where, like, Blackjack is, like, I find agreeable in this moment. Unfortunately, this scene gets a little dumb, or a little bit pointless, where, like, because he's doing this all in front of his cyborg brethren, that he's just unraveling that he did this for, like, selfish, evil reasons, and he just wants to wipe everything out. All the cyborgs he's conscripted into doing this were all people that have, like, families in Thunderhead or had lost
loved
ones. Well, they were cybernetic.
I'm sort of quoting a hypothetical cyborg wing horse.
Wait, what? What about omnicidal tendencies? And like this looks like it's going to be one of those moments where like the villain is hoisted by their own petard, but then he just like activates a kill switch that just makes them all die. And admittedly, they die pretty gruesomely, and I kind of like that at least, because it really like it is a good kick the dog moment to showcase like no, this guy needs to die. He can't be reasoned or pardoned with, because all the cyborgs like they don't just like die. Like it doesn't just like brain function terminates. It's all their cybernetics shut off, but their meat is still running, but it needs all the organs inside it running. So they just violently die on their own, like, organ failure, which is pretty brutal. And it's very evocative. It's a good tone setter. This causes RBD to lose it on Lighthooves, and, you know, we get a very Dragon Ball style scene where, like, RBD smashes into Lighthooves at full speed, and they just dart around like bullets. Like they're basically impossible to see. They're just blurs of color smashing into each other, which I think is fun. Well, everything just being ripped apart about the building around them, which is very fun. BJ gets Boo to sneak off one of the targeting talismans, and BJ runs to the cockpit or trots to the gallop's probably the word.
She lunges.
She does that Pinkie Pie thing where she bounces. She gets into the system to try and like, you know, or like activate the systems to turn it down to shut down everything, and like the launch codes are all set to like a mandatory thing, and like just as she's starting to input the codes, like Lighthoof just barrels through a reinforced window. Lands on top of BJ and sweeps her through the room back out into the main area. So he's just like covered in glass and wounds now. Him and BJ have an absolute slobber knocker. Like, I don't talk about combat very often in this story because it's often very boring, but this fight is super intense for a bunch of reasons. Like, there's a part, like a couple of highlights that come to mind is there's a bit where BJ and Lighthooves are fighting and flying, and then like BJ just deactivates her wings and just lets the entire weight of her body just land her and Lighthooves onto the catwalk, which just shatters all the bones in his wings, and then just gores him with her horn. The entire time, both of them are on fire. Because one of the missiles is leaking propellant, so like Lighthooves is super busted up. He's like got a sucking gape wound. His wings are completely shattered. He's like he's described as like most of his hair is completely burned off and half his face is melted. They're just like it's just fucking nuts. Like it's a really intense fight scene.
All right.
There's this weird thing too, where like because Lighthooves like knows BJ's story, it's like he's like, no, you got to do it, you got to like you know kill me, you coward, and BJ you know responds, I'm not an executioner, which this has an unfun.
You're in the middle of a life or death fight. What the fuck?
there's a really unfun line that she amends to it in her brain, that she's like, I'm not an executioner, and like those words have never felt more hollow or cowardly, is what she thinks to herself. And it's just like, oh, come on, this sucks. But yeah, he's just like laying on the ground, like just bleeding out from this ridiculous fight. And BJ's like, no, it's over. I have the upper hand. I have the trump card. As Light Hooves is bleeding out and dying, he's given one last request. He's like, I need to know what's on that damn piece of paper. And she shows it to him, and it's like, oh, I guess it's all over then. And it was from the start. And then like we get this like crazy scene, which I loved, where like a bunch of Enclave flood in because it's all the Navarro Enclave because they're looking for the missiles, and like they now have them because of BJ leading them right to it. And they all like, you know, they all yell at her to disarm. And she's like, no, I don't have to disarm. I have this. And then shows them the piece of paper. We finally get to see what it says. It's like 15 letters and 4 words. I have a mega spell, which is fucking radical. because she has the targeting spell on her. So she just like hits the talisman into her pip buck, and it just, you know, fire on my position. A mega spell that's underneath the city. Remember all the way back when with the microwave hallway, when they got through that whole ordeal underneath the city. One of the things they found under there was a mega spell chamber that hadn't been fired. This is another case of you need to do like you didn't. There's no reminder of it. So I had to like go back and like look this up, and that's kind of where the scene gets a little bit diminished. Like the payoff is cool. Don't get me wrong, that like months and months ago in the podcast and in the chapters, they found a mega spell thing. It had nothing to do with it because there's no way they could have used it. And now they've given the perfect opportunity to do it. All this fire a while ago, but there's no in between mention. So it just comes across as, if you don't remember this detail, kind of like she's pulling it out of her ass. But instead, she, you know, it like pip butt lines a bunch of code and text. And it's like, do you want to fire this mega spell? Yes or no? She hits yes, obviously. Centered on her position. And it's like mega spell chamber fired implosion is the like call sign on it. Because Zebra, I've talked about this before, but Zebra mega spells were always nukes. Equestrian mega spells were just take a spell, maximize it to its nth degree. Like the heal spell just healed an entire battlefield back to life, or that kind of thing. So implosion is just a very, very simple spell maximized to its absolute goddamn limit. And we get this like crazy fucking like sort of like set piece where BJ is trying to escape like a building that is essentially being sucked into its center point. And she's trying to fly away from it, and like basically the middle of the tower is where this is being centered on. So people are all evacuating from it, and like the center of the tower essentially gets like bubbled into a ring of compressing matter at the middle of it as the whole building starts falling on itself, and as like everything is being rushed into the center point before it explodes. As BJ is like narrowly dodging through a bunch of debris and stuff in the sky, is basically the entire of this building is imploding and falling down on everybody. And we're almost done, but we get this one last like really cool scene as like particularly the building is cut up by the defense lasers of the core. And then like just as BJ thinks she's got out of it, like one of the raptors, like one of the dead husks of one of the raptors, like falls out of the sky, like out of the cloud wall, like directly on top of her, essentially. So our final scene of this book is a sky tank landing on Blackjack into the core, which is fucking nuts. But yeah, that's the end of our chapter.
And the end of our book, and the end of our story, because Blackjack is finally dead.
Nope.
Having been compressed to the center point of a miniature black hole.
Yeah.
Did they even establish that she has like rockets on her wings or something to like justify like how she can like at the center of a massive like imploding force struggle struggle out of it. Like,
well, it like took a while when, like, to
steel
like start
is buckling,
up. So it didn't just immediately like central point. She had like a few seconds to actually like get out of the facility before it like really kicked into high gear.
But like, she would still be at the center of the gravity. Like, I don't understand. But anyway, never mind. It's not a question worth asking, I guess.
I mean, you're also ultimately arguing with magic, like, is also part of the problem too.
I'm arguing with Somber, who like doesn't give a shit about things he sets up, like, and whatever. Like, the spell works however it fucking works.
I mean, it's still a cool set piece, and you can't take that away from me. But any notes going forwards before we do all our wrap up stuff?
I don't know. It reminds me of a very Moffat kind of twist. This is very clever. What's in the mystery box? Aha, it's this. And then like it operates under fridge logic. You know, like, oh yeah, that was very cool. And then you get up to get a sandwich and go, wait a minute, why did everybody respond the way they did? That doesn't nobody's responses really lines up with what was on the paper.
Well, I mean, like, so I guess a critical detail is it was explicitly telling people, like, don't say what this is aloud, because then Light Hooves will know. So that's why they responded of just going, like, that's why they were playing the, like in the, I can't remember what it's called, but it's the, like, the, oh, we're not going to say what it is because the audience can't know, which, I mean, admittedly, is just a...
No, I'm just trying to imagine, especially, like, Rainbow Dash, who has no, like, frame of reference for this, like, should probably have read that and like, looked at her and said, you what?
No, she knows what a mega spell is.
No, like, but why would you have one? It's a rigid, it's the equivalent of saying, I have a nuke. And, like, if somebody handed me a paper with just that phrase on it, I have a nuke, like, my response would not be, oh, how clever, oh, that's crazy. It would be, like, you what? that's neither here nor there. It works well enough, like, just in the way that Stephen Moffat.
Yeah. Well, I don't even think it's a Stephen works Moffat well enough. I think outside of just nitpicking the, like, logistical consistency of it, I think it's still a cool set piece, and, like, that's just...
That is what I am saying. It works well enough. It's fringe logic can be fine, especially, like, when your standards are this low. I don't have anything else except to say that Somber beat us on this one. Like, Blackjack finally beat up a dude with a name, no less.
Yeah, and like in a pretty hardcore way too.
Putting aside that, like, he had to establish that he was sick that day, and also half of the fight was done by one of the main six.
Yes, who is in like Batman armor.
So yeah, there's a lot of like a lot of cushioning between a man and Blackjack being able to beat him. But she did trounce him. She did hurt him.
She did it.
Hurt him an awful lot. Did him powerful hurt.
And done did hurt him.
Yeah. Is there anything better we could be?
I don't think we have time for anything like that.
The only thing, like, it's sort of a non-endorsement because everybody's already playing Doom Eternal, but I've heard nothing but good reviews for Doom Eternal, and one of my favorite things about it as somebody who doesn't own it, I'm never going to play it myself, but what I do appreciate from like the clips and spoilers I've seen is the running theme of Doom Guy being pure direct action manifest. That, like, the running joke, the running theme of the game is people and things telling Doom Guy, you can't.
Yes, specifically you can't.
And even if you could, you shouldn't.
Specifically, you can't save them. That's the thing. It's like, you can't save humanity. You can't stop this. This is by design. And it's like, no, you die. You have huge body and huge guts. I'm going to separate those two things.
But yeah, like, and everybody knows the meme by now. If you can't blow a hole on Mars, and like, as though to illustrate Doomguy's thought process, the quest objective appears on the top left side of your screen and blow a hole in Mars. Ding, 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 ding. What? Wait, what's that? Ding, ding, ding. Oh, it's Jingles the Mailbot! Hey, Jingles, what do you got for us?
Yay, Jingles.
Jingles has a message here. The heading is fan mail. Praise be to Gun.
Yes. More acolytes of the Gun.
You can start a religion over this. Salutations, Sir Viceroy Admin Weirdington. I'm one of your numerous listeners. That's surprising. We have numerous of those.
We have dozens of them.
I'm one of your numerous listeners and just recently caught up in your show after 2-3 weeks of stuck in home syndrome. That's going around here in the Afterscape. Under a friend of the podcast, Wandering Zebra's recommendation. Thank you, Wandering Zebra. I've thoroughly enjoyed it so far, even if I do not get all the political references you two make or totally agree with exactly everything you two say. Burn Nazis at the stake, though, as Trotsky and Senator Long might have wanted. So, as that is actually in the text, in case you might have thought it was my addition further into the text. So, as to what could be done after this manifesto of your sombreros, I highly suggest you do the original FOE to cleanse your palate of the current filth on the menu. But you doing the reading, Magistrate Weirdington, for a nice format change. Plus, I legitimately want to hear your take on the direct story. Additionally, please avoid speak. I was told by the author it was a try at slice of life, and it's based on PH. And Fuhrer Sombrero was one of the editors until recently. And it goes darker than PH did in some ways, with an even more pointless and forgettable supporting cast. Also, its premise is to rehabilitate Blackjack, so yeah, just never touch it. That's how it reads in the text. There's a prolonged in the yeah.
Yes.
With that, I shall conclude for now. I hope you your situation can improve. I donate, but I'm unemployed, unfortunately. That's going around. Thank you for reading, and I hope the roleplay wasn't too aggressive. Signed, Sir Valentinian IV.
Well, thank you, Valentinian. I think that the idea of getting Weird to be fully exposed to the original story is like a bearable idea. I think it's a fun idea.
It's interesting. I'm increasingly set on. I think the next podcast is probably going to be doing this, but with Dominic Deegan.
Well, I think that's going to be like our sort of expounded universe kind of equivalent.
We will
keep doing this
podcast. Like, yeah, we'll keep doing this, and
yeah, regardless of
actually.
Regardless of. Just to reiterate, regardless of what else we do, we will still be continuing to do fanfic of a fanfic as a podcast, but in addition, we'll be doing a Dominic Deegan thing as well.
Yeah. So I think that's actually a pretty valid idea that neither of us had considered before. That it would be interesting to have a complete outsider, a non-pony reading FOE. And with a small horse giving their commentary without reading it, with only relying on my enumeration of the text,
and of course my own
to remind them, as a diligent small horse, Fies of course read the original work, but they are henceforth forbidden from touching the sacred liturgy until I have completed it, completed my own speed run, the slowest of all speed, a slow run, if you will.
Slow books read slowly.
But thank you.
Thank you. What was the name again?
Well, I could give the name that's on the handle, but they signed it They add an extra EN, Mr. Valentine, or as they signed Mr. Valentinian the fourth.
Valentinian. All right. Well, thank you for the email. It's we love emails here. Weird eats them for sustenance. Delicious consumption.
In addition to chili.
Yes, it's bowls of chili full of emails. But yeah, and if you want to send weird some delicious email gruel, where would we send it?
Send it to weirdingtonesq@gmail.com. You can also check out our Twitters. Fize, as we alluded to in this episode, is extremely not safe for work. Though he, it's extremely not safe for work and very political. Mine, and that's thou art at thou art Fi on Twitter. Mine is at Weirdington E, and it's a mix of cute animals, neat art, projects that I find other people have done. And my own, like, curling tomatoes at libs. I just hate them so deeply. Telling Biden supporters to go into the sea. Is just my main engagement on Twitter now.
I mean, which is like, valid. If you look,
just go into the sea. If you're voting for Biden, please, for the love of God, return to the depths of the ocean. Never return. God, I think that's it. And next week we're gonna have to talk about the entire book.
Yep, it's gonna be a recap.
No.
Yep.
No, fine. But no, don't make
at least, at no, least, at fine. Least, at least, at least. It does mean we get to do book five, where everything gets really silly. Yay!
More so than ever. This has definitely been a terrible mistake.
But I couldn't come home in the dark.